Marvel continues next Thursday at 3:30 with part 3 of Francis's 3-part series on alto saxophonist Lee Konitz. It's 9 minutes after 4 o'clock. Joining me is a very special guest, sculptor, landscape architect, theater designer, Isamu Noguchi, who is in Philadelphia for the opening of a major show of his work at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. The show, which is called Imaginary Landscapes, originated at the Walker Art Center in Minneapolis. It opens Sunday at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Isamu Noguchi was born 75 years ago in America to an American mother and Japanese father. His work draws on the imagery of both cultures. He has said that he's resigned to the fact that in Japan he's frequently perceived as being an American sculptor, while in America he's frequently perceived as being Japanese. New York is now his place of residence, though much of his life continues to be spent traveling from city to city and country to country. His work has been commissioned in many parts of the world. Isamu Noguchi has described himself as a traditional sculptor who makes contemporary images that relate to history. The show, which opens tomorrow at the museum, features many different aspects of his legendary career: sculpture in wood, stone, marble, and bronze. His abstract sets for Martha Graham's dance performances are shown. His designs for urban gardens, including the Chase Manhattan Plaza in New York and the UNESCO headquarters in Paris. Spaces devoted to models and photographs of some of his monumental sculptures, as well as to designs for unrealized projects and urban playgrounds. One of the themes that has developed in his work since the late 60s has been the square balanced on its point, a form that seems to defy gravity. Perhaps you're familiar with his red cube, which sits on its point outside the Marine Midland Bank in Manhattan. Projects completed in the 70s include his fountain for the Detroit Civic Center and his tubular steel sculpture portal for the Justice Center in Cleveland. The show of his work again opens at the Philadelphia Museum of Art on Sunday, and within that there's going to be a space called Variable Landscape, which will feature lamps and sculptures by Isamu Noguchi, and performances will take place within that space. There will be performances every Wednesday through Sunday throughout the duration of the show at 12:30. Isamu Noguchi, welcome to Fresh Air. It's such a great pleasure to have you here.
Well, I'm very glad to be here.
You have said that you see the artist as being the shaman of a society. Could you elaborate on that for us?
Well, you might say a shaman. He catches some things that seem to be floating through the air, you know, and if he, you know, isn't just being an egoist, he's sort of, his tentacles, you might say, a little bit more sensitive than others, but still it's the same tentacles, people all hear it, otherwise it wouldn't register as being of any significance, but he automatically and unconsciously feels things that are pertinent and you know, maybe he's a little bit ahead of his time, a little bit behind the times or something, but at least, you know, what he deals with has some pertinence to other people, so they recognize it. And so they recognize it because they've heard the same thing someplace before, you know, in their imagination.
Art no longer seems to be tied in with rituals of a culture, with the ceremonies of a culture, not to the extent that it was in tribal cultures or in older civilizations. Is that regrettable, do you think?
Well, yes, in a way. But, I mean, you see, that's because we have lost the identity of place and so forth, which made for the development of these things. I mean, we have them occasionally in special situations, for instance, like in a theater, you know, where you have a hypothetical situation of ritual and meaning, you see. And, of course, I did, for quite a few years, quite a number of sets, especially for the dance, you know, of Martha Graham and some for, you know, for the ballet. But those were all, in a sense, ritualistic situations which were self-created by those particular people and did not necessarily represent a very large sort of a ritualistic background. However, you know, those things did grow and did become a part of our, you know, common heritage, so to speak, you know, so that, you know, if we don't have the church and we don't have the cultural sort of idiosyncrasies, you know, that make for ritual, we do have, you know, this the artistic input, you know, which makes for a ritual. You know, the artist makes the situation and gives the sort of the platform upon which a ritual situation can take place. You know, it's a kind of an enclosure. It's a special situation, whether it's a space platform, a platform of theater, a platform of special, you know, concentration. You're inside a box. You're within yourself. You're within a group. You know, so people look for a certain protective confines, you know, within which a ritual can take place, whether it's a commonly accepted one or a very special one. We need all this, special conditions to protect us from the general situation and give us a kind of meaning to ourselves. I mean, we all need to have some meaning in what we do. You know, we have to be. We look for our own ritual, you might say.
So, are you suggesting that art can perform the kinds of functions for us that, for some people, religion can no longer perform?
Yes, I think that art. And indeed, museums and in as much as people turn to art as their own way of searching for a ritual, a relationship that they might have to other people in other situations, is important. You know, and if the religion, for instance, has less significance today, art has more.
How does this apply to your view of your work, for instance, outside of urban skyscrapers? We're not in that enclosed theatrical environment or museum environment in which we can experience a very intimate sharing space with the art.
Mm-hmm. You mean to say, what is it like outside of the museum and the theater?
Well, when you were working, say, with the Red Cube, for instance, outside the Marine Midland Bank in New York, art as ritual becomes a very different thing, if you can still look at it in that context.
Yes, of course, the Red Cube was made because I became interested in the building and the space in front of it, you know, as being enclosed and within, certain confines, which called for, I had been previously asked to do something to the building, and it had gone, by the way, there was no money and this and that. But then I realized that there might be still some possibilities, so I called the architect and said, look, I'm interested in your building. Perhaps we could do something, not great expense, which would have a function which, well, in a way, ritualistic, yes. I mean, that is to say, people would come there and recognize something that was there in this space, which filled this void of this space in a way, And it was not a space that I made, but it was a space that was congenial to me. I don't, like to do things which are not related to the space around it in a very specific way. I don't just do sculptures and then sell it, and say, well, put it on when you want, but I generally do things for that particular space, and I did so for that space. That cube was made for that space and no other place, you see. Although, of course, I had done previously such cubes, as you mentioned, on points. For instance, in the Beinecke Rare Book Library at Yale University, there's a cube on its point, In that case, I thought of the cube as being that indeterminate thing, which could roll either way. I mean, it was like a dice, it was a chance. And I thought of it in those terms, that it was an unstable thing, But in the case of the Red Cube, it becomes something else, although it has the same shape, excepting that in the case of the Red Cube downtown, it's really not a cube, it's a rhomboid. It's an odd shape, but people don't recognize it as that right away, you see. It's peculiar. It seems to fly off, and that's because of a little trick of geometry.
It's weighted more in one direction.
No, it's odd.
Do you think symbolically?
No, I don't actually think symbolically. Of course, in the Yale Library case, you know, I did, you might say, think symbolically. I mean, the sun, you know, and the earth as the pyramid, the cube as chance, all that sort of thing. Yes, I talked of it and I thought of it in a sense symbolically. But generally speaking, I don't think things symbolically. I work, you know, you might say plastically, functionally, you know, structurally, all that, but not symbolically.
Is there a message that you ever want viewers to get from your work, or is it something other than...
Not the message, no. I'm not out to make messages, and I'm not, you know, out to make monuments. I'm just interested in sculpture as relationships of form, space, people, the experience of the tactile world, you know, which gives a sense of reality, you know, perhaps through our eyes, perhaps through our walking, perhaps, you know, through, you know, our realization of ourselves and the world around us, you know. You know, I don't, you know, it's not a symbolical thing, but a real thing that I try to do. I try to find some real relationship between people and their surroundings.
I've heard one or two architects say that they don't always like the idea of sculpture being put alongside their buildings, because buildings don't need decoration, they don't need adornment. Mm-hmm. If a good architect constructed the building, it has a wonderful form of its own that is a statement unto itself. How would you react to a statement like that?
Well, I don't believe in adornment either. I don't like adornment. I don't like to be decorating a building. That's the reason I don't like to stick something on a building, you see. If a sculpture cannot stand up an equal, you know, relationship to a building, you know, formally as size and as importance and so forth, well, it's not for me, you see. And so that I don't believe in decoration, and I don't believe in symbols. Such, you see. And although you may say afterwards, oh, well, it has some symbolical meaning, you know. it may even have a decorative meaning for all I care, but I don't do it as decoration.
Do you think that most people are prepared to contend with sculpture that isn't a statue or that isn't a formal fountain in the traditional sense? Monumental sculptures used to be statues of great people, monuments to people, to events of the past. And much of your recent sculpture is monumental, but it's abstract.
Yes. Of course, I don't really believe in monumental sculpture, you see. I think that things simply big means nothing. It's only in relation to things that that size has any meaning. And, of course, the popularity of large monumental sculptures today is, I think, comes from the very fact that the scale of things have so outgrown man's dimension, you know. Buildings are so stupendously big, you know, and trees don't seem to grow alongside the buildings as to the height that they're supposed to do. I suppose, you know, trees should be about 10 stories high, but you don't find those kinds of things. So they try to get a sculpture that's that big, you know, and it's not that successful. But anyway, it falls into a category of a hunger for something, but not necessarily that it's right that way. You know, after all, peoples don't change. People's scale is just so big, you know. And as for how big sculptures should be, well, it's a question of relationships, scale. And whereas I don't believe in monumental sculptures, I have done some pretty big sculptures, you know. For instance, the portal that I did in Cleveland is 35 feet high, you know, and it's about 40 feet across. It's very pretty big. Well, it was only big because that situation called for such a size, you know. Otherwise, I wouldn't do it. I don't like to do things big just because to be big, you know. It means nothing to me. And I would not do things for, you know, just to put any old place, you know. It would have to be in relation to that particular spot, because the place is very, very important. I mean, we live in this world. We have a place in this world. It's not just an abstraction. We are in an actual situation, you see. And it's not the idea, but the place that really, motivates me.
Let's apply this to the work that you've done with sculpture gardens, which is also frequently within an urban landscape.
Yes.
What kinds of responses do people usually have within your sculpture gardens?
Well, actually, since I'm a sculptor, everything I do is, in a sense, sculpture, you see. Some gardens I do, have trees and so forth, and yet are sculptures, so far as I'm concerned, like the UNESCO garden, you know. And it is a garden of contemplation, and people go there, and they're not looking for sculpture per se, excepting the place is a kind of a sculpture, you see. And other things like the Israeli garden at the National Museum in Jerusalem is a sculpture garden, which Billy Rose asked me to do. Well, I was rather hesitant to do a sculpture garden for other sculptors, you know. After all, I'm a sculptor. Why should I be doing a garden for other sculptures, you know? And I'm a little dubious, but still, I did it. Every experience does open up, one's imagination to such other possibilities. And, I did that. It was about 5 acres big. I mean, it's a pretty big sculpture, if you want to call it a sculpture. A sculptor can always foil it by making a monument, 5 stories high, and then you're sunk, you see. Everything is scale. A garden is only good for certain scale sculpture, you know, not too big, not too small. I mean, there's a kind of relationship. I mean, everything is scale. And I think man is really the proper scale of things. I mean, man, his relationship, you know. He can dream of going to the moon, you know, and he can dream of the Statue of Liberty, if you wish. Given an ocean, you can have a very large sculpture. Given a plaza, given a museum room, you have different dimensions. Given a theater space, you have another dimension. It's all related.
Being in one of your gardens would offer the opportunity to actually inhabit a sculpted space, because it's not a question of it's just a little empty space with a few little sculptures stuck into it. Mm. We're talking about designing a whole space in a, from the documentations I've seen, a very sensual kind of way. Mm. So you're inhabiting a whole space, not just walking between little...
Yes, of course, you see,
sculptural items.
You know, when I think of space, you know, and sculpture, the first set I ever did for Martha Graham, for instance, was a single piece of rope, you know, which went from the back of the stage on the floor up forward to the top ends of the proscenium and cut the whole stage space, the volume of the stage, of the air there, you know. This is called fresh air, isn't it?
Yeah.
That was all air, you know, just the air of the stage space was bisected by these lines, you know, which created the sense of perspective, you know. To me, that was sculpting space, you know, sculpting air. There was nothing there but a rope, you know. But to me, it was kind of the essence of sculpture in space. And when I mean space, I mean that kind of space. It can be almost any size. You can start sculpting out in outer space if you wish, you know. And so when I talk about a platform of ritual, well, you have a platform up in outer space. Somebody's imagination has already taken them up there, and they're out there, you know, in their own ritualistic surrounding, you know. They can be, singing a song. But that's today's, reality of the imagination, I imagine, is someplace up there.
So when I talk about your sculpture gardens, I should really talk about land and not space.
Yes, we're talking about the earth right now, you see. I think there's a lot to be done right here before we start flying off to the moon, you know, because all we're going to find wherever we go is really a kind of a reflection of the earth. We find just rocks, just like we have here. You know, it's what we do with the rock that counts, and it's our relationship, the man's relationship, not and mine, yours, everybody else's, to our own little space, and how we do with it, and how we relate to it. You see, this is the ritual of life.
Looking at photographs of your sculpture gardens, in many of them I noticed a lack of grass and trees, and it seemed to be concrete or stone mostly. Mm. Well, how do you decide when a garden calls for greenness?
Well, that's not true. I do not use concrete, first of all.
Okay.
Some of the gardens, like the Chase Manhattan, has stone, let's say, you know. So is this true of Yale Garden? The Israeli Garden has trees, and the UNESCO is full of trees. So it's not quite true what you say. I believe in space, and I think trees and so forth can be a nuisance, you know, especially since they're not in the proper scale, you know. I'm going to be doing something in Bologna, Italy, a piazza, you know. And in Italy, they don't want any trees in their piazzas, you know, because they think it's a distraction. And it's one of the stipulations. No trees, you see. Fine. It's fine with me. Well, we have a granite piazza, you see, and I'll be working with stone. And it's my preferred medium, by the way.
Stone?
Oh, yes.
Some of the sculptures that you've done in urban landscapes have been steel or other metals.
Well, I tell you, when things get out of scale, very big, you know, you're forced to use materials like metals, steel, and so forth. It's the only thing that's possible to build that big within the kind of budgets that you are permitted, you see. After all, you can do things in stone almost any scale, but it's going to cost an awful lot of money. And so you do what you can under the circumstances, you see. But if you ask me, the relative value of stone or steel or whatever it is, you know, I would say that those materials which do not pollute, you know, who are those which are in the ecological system of nature, you see, like stone, for instance, age. Everything ages, but stone ages and gets better as it grows older, you know. Some things fall apart, like concrete, you know. Some things don't age properly, like steel, you know, plastics disintegrate, you know, so we are left with stone. And you know, we go to the moon, we go to Mars, what do we find but stone, you know? Stone in the beautiful process of aging, you know. They age up in Mars, I'm sure, just as well as in the Earth. And, you know, and we age too, by the way, you know. We all are in this wonderful sort of flow back, you know, in this rapid sort of sucking into a future which funnels and we sort of disappear, you know. But this process, all of which is going at the same speed of disintegration, of oxidation, or whatever you call it, you know. And that's what I find so beautiful with stone, because they say, well, stone lasts. Yeah, it lasts a lot better than plastic or perhaps bronze, but it ages beautifully. It doesn't... you know, it's still alive, you know. It still is there. And so long as we live, we're alive, you know. Of course, the moment we're no longer alive, we're no longer alive. But while we're alive, we're still human beings in a certain state of decomposition, but still, he's still here, you know, and we function, you know. We're just as bright as we ever were, I mean, we continue.
When you're choosing a material to work with for one of your projects, how much of a consideration is money going to be, the expense of that material?
Oh, very much. Very much, because you can only, do things within the budget. I mean, you know, so much is allowable. However, I mean, you can cut corners, you know. You can find ways of doing things with tools, with the materials that you think ought to be, and... It's amazing the possibilities that are inherent, you know, in the fact that we are able to have the command of the tools we have, you see. It's the tools we have that makes stone, for instance, a very modern medium, you know. It is a direct medium because we work directly on the stone. We're not making a model. We're not, you know, translating it into some other medium. We're not casting it on this and that. It's not a reproduction medium. When you make it, it's it. and therefore you work straight into it, you see, without all this, fussing around with other skills and other, sort of technologies and so forth, which are quite irrelevant to the art. The art being the direct communion and communication of the man who makes it, the material he makes it in, and the people who enjoy it, you see.
Some people think that they should feel cheated when an artist had people work with him chiseling the stone or doing the prints if they're a printmaker. What do you think of that?
No, you have to have absolute control of whatever you're doing, you see. So if you're merely getting somebody else to make it for you, you lose out. I mean, you're no longer in control, you see. However, I mean, you might use a workman to help you with the chiseling. That is true, but you're not. It's not a reproductive process. It's a continuously changing process. And of course, with stone, you have the stone to cope with, which is always, a special situation with a special conditions of fractures of the stone itself, what it lends itself to being, the uniqueness of its shape, the possibilities are limited. It's the limits, really, that permits for originality, you see. And the limits and the accidents, I might say, are inherent in natural mediums, which permits for real, you might say, the response of the artist in improvisation and in answering each problem as it rises. He has to give an answer immediately, you see. This, to me, is art. I mean, it's not a preconceived, conceptualized plan such as architects make, you know. It is the constant sort of dialogue between the artist and the medium. It is not something that you get somebody else to make.
And then the dialogue continues with the people who see the work.
That's right, yes. And they must feel the dialogue that the artist has had in making it continues, and it's a continuous dialogue, which continues on beyond him, and forever and ever. I mean, if you look at Michelangelo's slaves, you can see the dialogue that he had, and why he stopped where he stopped, where he went on, where he went on, and so on, There was, you find it's a live thing.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Isamu Noguchi, and he's in Philadelphia for the opening of his show at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. The official opening is Sunday, and there's a lot of performances that will be held in a space within there, a space that will contain some of his work. It's a space being called Variable Landscapes. Let's talk a little more about some of the monetary aspects of art. The fountain that you did at the Detroit Civic Center cost $200,000.
No. There was left $2 million for it. I was asked to make a sculpture for $2 million.
Oh, $2 million. Oh. Left out a lot of zeros.
No. It cost more than that, actually. But we started off with $2 million. You see, and you say, well, now spend $2 million. It's not that easy, I mean, how do you make a sculpture for $2 million? A fountain, It's very easy to spend $2 million. But anyway. And then, after having made a proposal for the fountain, the firm that had already gotten the job to do the plaza and had made the plans for it, and had started it, as a matter of fact, the chairman of the board, who also happened to be the chairman of the fountain selection committee, Mr. Robert Hastings, said, look, obviously, our plans don't fit your fountain. I think you better do the whole plaza. So that's how I got to do the whole plaza, you see. And the plaza, it grew in its possibilities and so forth. We started out with no money, but there was some money for the Hastings, for the Smith Henchman and Grills proposal. But anyway, It went on and on and on and kept growing and so on. As you can imagine, it cost a lot of money, including a big roadway underneath, which the government puts in, and so on and so forth. And so it's become quite a thing. And, you know, if a thing is worthy of it, it finds its support, and then you are able to make it, you know. And nothing ever starts out full-blown, you know, excepting maybe preconceived commercial architectural projects, which are then made for just that purpose and has no inkling of art in it. But things that are of art grow with the necessities of the art, you see, and the possibilities and the desire of people. If your people don't want it, nothing will ever happen, you know. And in a way, the proposal of what is possible in art has to come from the artist and not from somebody in a committee, you know. Who is to say what's going to be? What is art anyway? I mean, it's something that the artist thinks up, not somebody else, you see. Nobody can tell me what to make, and I don't know what to make either, for that matter, you know. But there has to be some kind of a beginning someplace, and it might as well be a fountain or whatever you want to start with, you know.
Not everyone in a community believes that art is worth investing that amount of money into when there's people starving within the community, when housing is falling down.
Well, you might say that's true, yeah. Excepting that, you know, Detroit was not what you would call a very, you know, promising place, you know, especially when we started this, you know, it's sort of a disaster area, you know. And you might say that, well, what's the point of art, you know, to a situation like that? But in actuality, this plaza has been the great outlet of hope. I mean, I understand there were almost 500,000 people there on the weekend of the 4th of July, you know. And it's been tremendously popular. I mean, why? Because it has this element of art in it, and people feel it, you see. So that, you know, and as for the timidity of investment and because of the poverty of people, you know, that's, I'm afraid, has a great deal to do with politics and with the self-image and self-protective attitude on the part of politicians and so forth, you know. I mean, for instance, I may or may not succeed with this affair in Bologna, you know. But it's a communist city, of course, and the mayor of Bologna is terribly worried about the expenditure of any recognizable amounts of money for a plaza, you see. They say, oh, no, please don't make something that looks like a lot of money. Please make it look less, you see. Of course, what I'm trying to do is to make more out of less, you know, to make something that is within the budgetary possibilities, but to look it really look grand, you know, and give people the feeling of you know, of hope and possibility, you know, the beauty of a beautiful Italian evening with music playing, you know. Yeah. But, I mean, how are you going to do it, you know? I mean, and save people from being criticized.
You have roots in two cultures, in Japan and in America. Do you have parts of you that feel kinships with both of those?
Yes, I feel kinship with both and with, you know, I feel... Well, actually, I feel a citizen everywhere, you know, in a way. I mean, I don't particularly feel chauvinistic. I'm, you know, I think most artists really would prefer it that way anyway. They'd rather have an international passport if they could.
Well, do you think that art functions differently in Iran than in Japan, than in America, than in Bologna? Do you think that people, ultimately, wherever they are, relate to art in similar ways, no matter what their cultural context and past history is?
I think so. I don't know about Iran, but, I mean, I would say that you know, the United States or Italy or Japan, I mean, ultimately, there's no difference, excepting there is a timidity in one place or another more than other places, because they don't know, you know, whether it's acceptable or whether you can get away with it or what it is, you know. I mean, I think America is the land of possibility because people have accepted art, you know, as something that is viable in relation to their own life. And maybe maybe it's because we are able to afford it, I don't know, but I don't think that is necessarily because it is cheap, you see. I think that the expensive art, which you inquire about, is very, very little consequence, you know, from the good it could bring to a community. And I think it's so much less expensive, let's say, than architecture, you know, that if you really balance the good that one does as relative to the other, well, art is a very cheap matter. You know, what is it, 0.5%
Oh, right, you have designed a number of playgrounds, few of which in America have ever gotten realized. The first one in America was built in 1976, and you were proposing them...
Since 1933.
Yes,
I think I must have been the originator of the idea of a play environment for children, you see. And it was a thing called Play Mountain in 1933. I showed it to Robert Moses in 34 and got kicked in the teeth, generally speaking. And I was never able, and I've never been able, to do anything in New York City as a result, you see. It was 1946 where I finally was able to get something done in Atlanta. But of course, in the meantime, I mean, I kept on, you know, hammering at this thing. I'm rather stone in some ways, and also I thought of playgrounds as the sort of opening wedge of the possibility. You know, through the world of a child, it might be possible to work in your way into the world of adults, you know. So I kept on, you know, working on the idea of playgrounds and of play objects, which other people, of course, borrowed, you know, without any thanks to me. And realized before I was able to do anything at all. But I finally did one in Atlanta. And it's been very successful and very pleasant indeed. I think it's great.
How do your concepts for playgrounds differ from the traditional concrete playground with your monkey bars and your swings and sliding ponds?
Well, you've seen them around. I mean, I didn't do them, but you've seen them around already, you know. They are, first of all, full of color and full of fun, and a world rather than just a, as you say, a concrete, empty lot, which is what the playgrounds used to be, with a fence around it, with these the play sort of apparatuses, you know, which you bought from some company or another. When I saw Moses, I mean, he says, no, we cannot have anything that's dangerous like what you're proposing. It has to be of, standard things that we know that are safe, you see. Well, you know, what is safe? Well, you say, what we've used is safe. We're not going to have anything that we haven't used, you see. But if you want to be innovative, well, you have to imagine all the possibilities and consider that they're not dangerous. But that, you know, I mean, for instance, I said to him at the time, I remember, I said, why don't you have some color in your playgrounds? And he says, we paint everything brown. We have 56 playgrounds, and we can't possibly afford to have any other color than brown. And he, you know, he practically threw me out of the place as being an annoyance. And I've never been able to do a thing in New York, probably as a result of Mr. Moses's, you know, power, which still prevails, you see, in the mentality of the people.
Some of your playgrounds and some of your other sculptures and designs are as yet unrealized pieces. What relationship do you have to your pieces that remain models that have never received the funding or the place to become the full idea?
I mean, for instance, the project I worked on for 5 years with Louis Kahn for Riverside Drive in New York City, I'd love to see that realized. All the plans are ready. The money at one point was all raised, you see. Now it'll probably cost a lot more. I don't see why it wouldn't be possible to realize it today, you see. If we can, again, can get up the money and get the city people to back it. I don't know how that can be done, you know. I mean, I'm not a politician and I'm not that persistent in, you know, trying to do one thing when I have so many other things that I'm busy with, you know. But it seems to me a shame, especially with Louis Kahn not having a thing in New York City, you know. It was a beautiful plan. I wish it could be done.
One of your proposals was for a face on Earth with a nose that would have been a pyramid,
yes,
1 mile high, to be seen from Mars?
Mars, yes, yes, yes. Well, you know, it was at that time when the atomic bomb had been dropped. And, you know, after a couple of years of reflection, one had the feeling that really, you know, there wasn't much chance on Earth, you know. Unless we could avoid dropping that second bomb or third bomb, you know. And, you know, I did this little sketch, you know, partly with tongue-in-cheek, of course, that if we're going to no longer be here, we might like to leave something as a memento of what it was like here, you see, and that somebody else could see up on Mars, you know. And following that, I got a foundation fellowship and took a trip around the world for a couple of years to study the environment of leisure, those environments that you find used ritualistically, let's say, those things you mentioned at the beginning of this interview, having to do with the spaces in relation to piazza, churches, this, that, and the other, temples. And I took a long trip, you know, which covered the world and covered time, so to speak, from the Neolithic on, you know. It was my study period, you might say, because I wasn't sure whether it was going to continue or was going to end up, you know, with a bang, you know.
You decided it was going to continue.
Well, I mean, if it was going to continue, I wanted to be ready for it, you see. And so I've been rather ready for it, you know, in a more sort of, you know, a larger scope, you might say, than most sculptors, because I was concerned that I should be ready for it, you know. I have more capacity for doing things than most people because I have a larger base, you know, larger base in the world, in its relation to people and its function to people, and not just merely some personal sort of peculiarity of sculpture, you know, in itself, but that it relates in a sense functionally and socially and in spatially and in its you might say aspect of air and fresh air and all that, you know, which has to do with ecology and survival and the life, you know.
Your sculpture's going to live for a long time and live in many parts of the world at that. Is immortality through your art something that's of interest to you? Is that something you think about?
Well, you know, immortality would depend upon whether any of us exist, you see. I mean, that is to say, if the world doesn't blow up, well, there's a certain, you know, period of immortality, but that's not going to last forever. I mean, I'm quite sure that the whole universe is going to explode. I mean, in fact, I'm told so, that it's going to all come to an end very, very soon, in a few billion years, so that I don't really believe in immortality. But still, you know, it's been nice to have things around so that, you know, people could remember and say that, well, you know, this is a part of our heritage.
It's going to be around, if the universe is around for a few billion years, your sculpture will be around considerably a long time. Really, though, do you care about your work enduring past the time that you do?
Well, I think that if it still, you know, functions and survives, you know, and does not disintegrate, but is more beautiful, I don't say as beautiful, but more beautiful, because time has caressed it and made it better than it is, you know. I can only give a little shove. And the rest of it is nature that takes over, you know, and starts to whittle away on it with those little corrosive oxides and so forth. And, you know, and I depend upon stone and materials like that, you know, which will become better. Things like things of metal and so forth, is going to get worse. I mean, it's not going to get any better because it does not, with it, it's not within the ecological sort of stream, so to speak. And so I believe in nature.
Can we end this interview with an unanswerable question?
Yes.
What is beauty?
Well, I mean, I'm not going to answer it, obviously.
Okay, it's been a great pleasure having you here, Osamu Noguchi. I've so much enjoyed meeting you and speaking with you. I look forward to seeing a lot of performances in your variable landscape, the landscape within the museum, the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Osamu Noguchi is in Philadelphia for the opening of his show. It's a very major show at the Philadelphia Museum of Art that opens on Sunday. And you can see there works from every period of Osamu Noguchi's career, and you'll see works that we've referred to throughout the interview. Some of the sculptures are there. Sculptures that are obviously much too large to be enclosed in any museum space are represented either through models or through photographs. Some of the sets that he designed for Martha Graham's dance performances are there as well. There will also be performances within this variable landscape, and they will be Wednesdays through Sundays. Now, Wednesdays through Sundays, they'll be at 12:30 with repeat performances on Saturdays. And I'd like to just tell you some of the people who are going to be performing throughout this stay of the show. Woofy Bubbles will be performing, Leslie Burrs and Tyrone Brown, Khan Jamal, Pieces of a Dream, the Pennsylvania Ballet, the Pennsylvania Chamber Ensemble, Philadanko, the Philadelphia Chamber Players. There'll be many different kinds of musical, theatrical performances. I'd recommend calling the museum for a schedule. There is a schedule that is printed now, and that way you can make a point of attending the performances that you'd most want to see. I think it's going to be really exciting to see these performances within a space designed by Osamu Noguchi. Thank you so much again for being here.
Thank you.
That's it for this afternoon's Fresh Air. Tomorrow afternoon on the show, it's a celebration. It's our 25th anniversary this weekend. We've been around for 25 years, so tomorrow's a kind of a nostalgic party. We're going to spend all afternoon tomorrow thinking back to 1954, and here's how we're going to do it. Peter Hesbacher, who has a wonderful popular record collection, is going to be with us, and we're going to be hearing the top 10 tunes from the week of October 19th, 1954, and we'll also hear the tunes that were in the top 10 for the year of 1954. What about jazz? Well, Francis Davis will be with us to highlight some of the things that was in Downbeat magazine throughout 1954 and also to play for us some of what he considers to be the key sessions of 1954. And the movies? Well, Leonard Maltin, who wrote the book TV Movies, is going to join us on the telephone, and he's going to do a little critique on the Academy Award-winning films of 1954, and he'll tell us what films were completely overlooked by the critics that have turned out to be classics in their genre. And we'll do the same for TV with Dave Jacobs, who teaches courses on popular culture at Temple University. So all this coming up tomorrow on our birthday show. And by the way, we'll open up the phone lines, and I'd really like to hear what you were doing and thinking in 1954. And I hope to hear from people of many different ages who were, of course, many different ages in 1954, thinking and doing many different kinds of things. So that's all coming up tomorrow. I hope you can join us then. Contributing to this afternoon show has been Francis Davis. Technical director this afternoon was Joyce Lieberman. The associate producer of Fresh Air is Danny Miller. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. Have a very good evening. This is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia, listener-supported public radio.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Bob Edwards.
And I'm Susan Stamberg with All Things Considered.
It is not, as was reported in most of the media, to ask for a handout. It is to request a helping hand.
You failed to compete. And for your failure, you should get what the free enterprise system promises you. It's called loss.
You pays your money, you takes your chances, according to Congressman Richard Kelly. But Lee Iacocca hopes to find others in the Capitol who are more sympathetic. Tonight on All Things Considered, Mr. Chrysler comes to Washington to ask for help.
Also tonight, these stories. A federal judge says President Carter violated the Constitution when he terminated our mutual defense treaty with Taiwan.
The Nobel Prize for Literature is awarded to Greek writer Odysseus Elitis.
Another round of racial violence in Boston. School desegregation remains the issue.
Notes on martial law in South Korea as the Park government cracks down on dissidents.
A profile of Vietnamese refugees on an island off Malaysia.
Commentator Gayan Wilson has thoughts on Richard Nixon's townhouse.
And we ask this question, is the actress Greta Garbo really shy?
This evening on All Things Considered, first the news and William Drummond.
The Carter administration is working to overturn a court ruling yesterday attacking the legal basis for the president's main move to normalize relations with China. A federal judge said the president acted improperly when he ended a mutual defense pact with the Republic of China on Taiwan. The cancellation of the treaty was one of the main conditions demanded by Communist China for establishing normal relations with the U.S. But the judge ruled that the president could not do that without approval from Congress. Secretary of State Vance was asked today what it means for U.S.-China relations.
At this point, it does nothing to the relationship between us. I want to study the opinion. I have not had a chance to read it yet because I've been preparing for these hearings today. We will obviously be appealing the ruling. It is a ruling of the lower court. And as you know, very frequently rulings of the lower court get reversed.
But a Chinese communist diplomat says a serious problem in relations has been created by the judge's ruling. He says China believes the Carter administration will straighten out the situation. The 1979 Nobel Prize for Literature was awarded today to a Greek poet. Odysseus Elitis is not well known outside of Greece. His best-known work is a folklore-based poem entitled Worthy It Is. The Nobel Committee cited him for depicting man's struggle for freedom and creativity. The prize is worth $190,000. Supporters of the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty today defeated another attempt to change the treaty in a way that would effectively kill it. The proposed change would have forced new negotiations with the Soviet Union. The vote in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee was 10-5, but Chairman Frank Church said he expects more serious trouble for the treaty before the committee completes its work. NPR's David Insor reports.
Defeated today was a proposal by Florida Senator Richard Stone that would have insisted that certain Soviet diesel-powered submarines equipped with nuclear weapons be included under SALT II's limits. Treaty supporters argued success.